Welcome to the London Review Bookshop.
Thanks very much. And actually, what come to think of it, with Remainder, when it was first published in its little art press edition, the LRB shop was one of the first places in London to support it, so I'm really grateful. And okay, I'm going to read a short passage from quite early on in the book. If you listen to the radio in 1911, you don't hear voices or music or whatever. You just hear, well, noise and clicks against the noise. And the clicks are either long or short, corresponding to the dashes and dots of Morse code. And then the receivers would transcribe it afterwards. And most of the traffic would be ship to ship or ship to shore, but there was also a kind of army of mainly teenage boys in their bedrooms with little DIY radio sets, receivers, listening, kind of enchanted by the air full of what Rilke calls geräusch, right? Crackle of the universe. And this is exactly what's going on in this passage. The hero Serge is aged about 12, 13, and he's doing exactly that. The statics, like the sound of thinking, not of any single person thinking, nor even a group thinking collectively. It's bigger than that, wider and more direct. It's like the sound of thought itself, its hum and rush. Each night, when Serge drops in on it, it recoils with a wail, then rolls back in crackling waves that carry him away, all rudderless, until his finger, nudging at the dial, can get some traction on it all, some sort of leeway. The first stretches are angry, plaintive, sad, and always mute. It's not until, hunched over the potentiometer among fraying cords and soldered wires, his controlled breathing an extension of the frequency of air he's riding on, he gets the first quiet clicks that words start forming. First, he jots the signals down as straight graphite lines, long ones and short ones. Then, below these, he begins to transcribe curling letters, dim and grainy, in the arc light of his desktop. He's got two masks set up. There's a 22-foot pine one topped with 15 more feet of bamboo, all bolted to an oak stump base half buried in the garden. Tent pegs circle the stump round. Steel guy wires, double insulated, climb from these to tether the mast down. On the chimney of the main house, a pole 3 feet long reaches the same height as the bamboo. Between the masts are strung 4 18-gauge manganese copper wires threaded through oak lathe crosses. In Serge's bedroom, there's a boxed tuning coil containing 20 feet of silk-covered platinoid, shellacked and scraped. The transmitter itself is made of standard brass, a 4-inch tapper arm keeping Serge's finger a safe distance from the spark gap. The spark gap flashes blue each time he taps. It makes a spitting noise, so loud he's had to build a silence box around the desk to isolate his little RX station from the sleeping household, or, as it becomes more obvious to him with every session, to maintain the little household's fantasy of isolation from the vast sea of transmission roaring all around it. Tonight, as on most nights, he starts out local, sweeping from 250 to 400 metres. It's the usual traffic, CQ signals from experimental wireless stations in Maystown and Ellery, tapping out their call signs and then slipping into Q code once another bug's responded. They exchange signal quality reports, compare equipment, inquire about variations in the weather and degrees of atmospheric interference. Serge moves up to 500 metres. Here are stronger, more decisive signals. Coastal stations' call signs flung from towering masts, Poldhu's transmitting its weather report. A few nudges away, Malin, Cleethorpes, Nordyke send out theirs. Liverpool's exchanging messages with tugboats in the Mersey. Serge transcribes a rota of towing duties for tomorrow. Further out, the light ship tongues, reporting a derelict's position. The coordinates click their way in from to the Seaforth station, then flash out again to be acknowledged by Marconi operators of commercial liners, one after the other. The ship's names reel off in litany. Falaba, British Sun, Scania, Morea, Carmania, each name appendaged by its church, Cunard, Cunard's Line, Allen, Aberdeen Direct, Canadian Pacific Railway, Holland America. The clicks peter out, and Serge glances at the clock. It's half a minute before one. A few seconds later, Paris's call sign comes on, FL for Eiffel. Serge taps his finger on the desktop to the rhythm of the huge tower's standby clicks, then holds it still and erect for the silent lull that always comes just before the time code. All the operators have gone silent, boats, coastal stations, bugs, all waiting, like him, for the quarter-second dots to set the air, the world, time itself back in motion as they chime the hour. They sound, and then the headphones really come to life. The press digest goes out from Niton, Poldhu, Malin, Cadiz, Diario del Atlantico, Journal de l'Atlantique, Atlantic Daily News. Madero and Suarez shot in Mexico while trying to escape. Trade pact between Entretien de shocking domestic tragedy in Beau. Il fondatore husband unable to prevent. The stories blur together. Serge sees a man clutching a kitchen knife, chasing a politician across parched earth, past cacti and armadillos, while ambassadors wave papers around fugitive and pursuer, negotiating terms. Grain up 5, Lloyd's down 2, Australia all out for 421, England 62 for 3 in reply. Malin's got 10 private messages for Lusitania, 7 for Campania, 2 for Olympic. Request instructions how to proceed with the honour of your company on the occasion of weighing 7.5 pounds, a girl. The operators stay on after the Marconi grams have gone through, chatting to one another. Carrigan's moved to President Lincoln, Borstable to Malwa. The company football team drew 2-2 against the Evening Standard 11. Old Allsop, wireless instructor at Marconi House, is getting married on the 22nd. His tapper finger firing up her spark gap, short, then long. Olympic and Campania are playing a game of chess. K4 to Q7, K4 to K5, they always start K4. Serge transcribes for a while, then lays his pencil down and lets the sequences run through the space between his ears, sounding his skull. There's a fluency to them, a rhythm that's spontaneous, as though the clicks were somehow speaking on their own and didn't need the detectors, keys, or finger-twitching men who cling to them like afterthoughts. He climbs up to 600 and picks up ice report sent out from whalers. Floberg / Growler, 5-inch 10, 45, 63 lat, 36W, 12-inch 39.37 long. Field ice, 59 north, 42, 43, 54 lat, 14W, 45, 56, 25 long. Compagnie de Télégraphie Sans Fille reports occasional light snow off Friesland. Paris comes on again. Again the cycle pauses and restarts. Then Bergen, Cruikhaven, Tarifa, Malaga, Gibraltar. Serge pictures gardenias tucked behind girls' ears, red dresses and the blood of bulls. He hears news forwarded via Port Said and Rome from Abyssinia and sees an African girl strumming on some kind of mandolin, jet black breasts glowing darkly through light silk. Suez is issuing warnings of Somali raiders further down the coast. More names process by: Isle of Perim, Zanzibar, Isle of Socotra, Persian Gulf. Parades of tents line themselves up for him. Inside them, dancers serving sherbet. Outside, camels saddled with rich carpets, deserts opening up beneath red skies. The air is rich tonight, still and cold, high pressure, the best time of year. He lets a fart slip from his buttocks and waits for its vapor trail of its vapor to reach his nostrils. It, too, carries signals, odor messages from distant, unseen bowels. When it arrives, he slips the headphones off, opens the silence cabin's door to let some air in, and hears a goods train passing half a mile away. The pulsing of its carriage joins above the steel rails carries to him cleanly. He looks down at his desk, the half-worn pencil, the light's edge across the paper sheet, the tuning box, the tapper. These things, here, solid, tangible, are somehow made more present by the tinny sound still spilling from the headphones lying beside them. The sound's present too, material. Serge sees its ripples snaking through the sky, pleats in its fabric, joins pulsing as they make their way down corridors of air and moisture, rock and metal, oak, pine and bamboo. Above 650, the clicks dissipate into a thin, pervasive noise, like dust. Discharges break across this, distant lightning, aurora borealis, meteorites. Their crashes and eruptions sound like handfuls of buckshot thrown into a tin bucket or a bucketful of grain-rich gravy dashed against a wash boiler. Wireless ghosts come and go, moving in arpeggios that loop, repeat, mutate, then disappear. Serge spends the last half hour or so of each night up here among these pitches, nestling in their contours as his head nods towards the desktop and lights flash across the inside of his eyelids, pushing them outwards from the centre of his brain, so far out that the distance to their screen seems infinite. They seem to contain all distances, envelop space itself, curving around it like a patina, a mould. Once, he picked up a CQD, a distress signal. It came from the Atlantic, 200 or so miles off Greenland. The Pachitea, merchant vessel of the Peruvian Steamship Company, had hit an object, maybe whale, maybe iceberg, and was breaking up. The nearest vessel was another South American, Acania, but it was 50 miles away. Galway had picked the call up, so had Le Havre, Malin, Poldhu, and just about every ship between Southampton and New York. 15 minutes after Serge had locked onto the signal, half the radio bugs in Europe had tuned into it as well. The Admiralty put a message out instructing amateurs to stop blocking the air. Serge ignored the order, but lost the signal beneath general interference. The atmospherics were atrocious that night. He listened to the whine and crackle, though, right through till morning, and heard, or thought he heard, among its breaks and flecks, the sound of people treading cold, black water, their hands beating small disturbances into waves that had come to bury them. I'll stop there.
I love static is like the sound of thoughts. I think that's a great place to kind of ask you a few questions. If anyone knows Tom's writing, you know it's saturated with codes and signals and transmission and mediation and things like that. I was just listening to you then, but I was also just thinking about when we first met, which was back in 2005, and Remainder had just been published in Paris by Metronome, and I got this email from him, and it just says, "Hello, Lee Rourke, I've got a book, would you like to have a look at it?" And out of the ether. And I said, "Yes." And he says, and then you said, "Phone me back, here's my number." And I phoned you back, and he says, "Can you meet me?" I said, "Yeah." And you said, I said, "Where should I meet you?" Usually I meet people in pubs or they post me their books, because I was doing a lot of reviewing then. You said, "Bunhill Fields." And I said, "Okay, graveyard."
Well, it turned out that was exactly halfway between where you were and where I was.
Yeah,
it wasn't
yeah.
that. It wasn't okay. that.
I'm still building. But anyway, so I walk into Bunhill Fields, there's this triangulation of Defoe and Blake and Bunyan, and there you are, and you hand me Remainder. I didn't think much of it then, but I think it kind of sums you up as a writer, because everything is this kind of messing around with the symbolic order or things past, and also signals and things like that. But more so transmission, especially with C. I mean, I've read this twice now, and ostensibly it's about technology and transmission. But the thing I found about it is it's about the production of technology. It's not just about technology. You know, Serge, his father, your protagonist, he's constantly inventing. He's constantly trying to make, you know, his wireless system. When Serge, you know, serves in the First World War, the engineers are constantly trying to build this new plane, which you know, exceeds the previous, but they keep failing. It's never good enough. And then finally, you know, as we get to the latter stages of the novel, there's this, you know, building of this huge transmission network, the Empire, which ultimately fails again. And for me, it is the production of technology, and I'm interested in that because it's a very German novel. And I was put in mind of Heidegger's essay, The Question Concerning Technology, and he says that you know, the possibility of all productive manufacturing lies in revealing, and technology therefore is no mere means, it's a form of revealing. And I want you to kind of talk us through what you're trying to kind of articulate through technology and the revealing and the process of forming in technology, and why you think it's so linked to literature. Why is this link?
Okay, well, I start with the Heidegger thing, right? I mean, for him, it's about revealing, and that's what techne means, right? In Greek, it means to kind of reveal and unfold. But for Heidegger, it's always this double movement. It conceals as it reveals, and even what it reveals is concealment of revealment of concealment, almost like some infinite regress. And so it's kind of Gnostic almost. I mean, Heidegger was a Catholic, you know. I mean, he hadn't abandoned theism when he thinks about technology. And I think that's very much in the kind of German tradition. I mean, in Kafka, it works the same way. Technology isn't, for a sci-fi writer, technology is interesting in some kind of boyish way because it's just about all the wires and stuff. And I don't even know how to wire a plug, hardly. I mean, it's not what interests me. It's about this kind of, the way it maybe, not the way it stands in for something else, but the way it kind of maybe can play out this whole Gnostic process. So you get passages in, for example, in America, where Carl becomes fascinated with the lift that he's operating as a bellboy, and he just wants to know the kind of the mechanism behind the mechanism. And all the other lift boys are going, I too yearn to know this, but we shall never know. It will never be revealed to us. And or in the castle, you've got, you know, the static on the telephone seems like it's got, well, a connection to the castle and where he wants to be. And also it's got these kind of, seems to have these children's voices singing at an infinite distance just beyond the sound of hearing. It's this kind of seductive, like the mermaids for Eliot, but you're never going to swim with them. It's not going to happen. So it's this kind of double move, I guess, that's kind of aesthetically and kind of psychically interesting. I wouldn't use the word psychological, but that's kind of interesting from that point of view. And that's linked to literature, because literature is kind of the same. It's about revealing and concealing. Literature is technology in that respect.
And do you think you're revealing this kind of mode of transmission, where via technologies there is the hidden, there is this what's already lying underneath be brought to the...
Totally, but also reinterred as well. I mean, it's always that double move. I mean, a kind of piece of conceptual software, whatever, that I kind of kept in mind while I was writing this book was the notion of the crypt, as it's been elaborated by psychoanalysts, like most in particular Nicholas Abraham and Maria Torok out of Freud. And they talk about neurosis and especially melancholic neurosis as a type of crypt. So it's about encryption and encrypted transmission, you know, I mean, communication, but at the same time it's always about burial and encoding and putting out of view. And I guess that's what's kind of what's going on through technology here. But ultimately, you know, I was thinking about this because I knew you were going to ask me about technology, and I was kind of thinking on the way here, maybe this book isn't about technology at all. I mean, technology is just a big red herring. I mean, what it's about is networks, mm-hmm. And okay, the World Wide Web as it emerges in the early 20th century through radio, that's one network, but so is the network of the history of literature. You know, that they're kind of, the deaf children are reciting Ovid and all this kind of stuff, and family networks and networks of family secrets. I mean, that's what's really meshing or overlaying in a way. Okay. And then what I guess the real question is, what's in the networks? And the answer is desire. I mean, that's where it really gets interesting for me, the way that kind of networks mediate or carry desire. And that's what the book's kind of more profoundly about, more than the technology itself.
I think so. And also it ties in with the kind of melancholia, mm-hmm. and how that's tied in with technology.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Freud's, you know, technology as a form of prosthesis.
Yeah.
You know, we become godlike. I want to move on to that in a minute, but I want to stick to this kind of Germanic theme in this book. And this for me, the most exhilarating part of it is the part where Serge is, he's in the First World War, and he's you know, he's in the aircrafts flying. For me, it's a form of pure poetry. Those sections in the book, they echo, and you know, he's thinking of Hölderlin and writers like that, and it's basically this idea that he becomes this kind of godlike figure.
Yeah.
At that stage in the book. There's this kind of mapping of so much. There's the mapping below him. There's the mapping in
the
air.
The vapor trails.
So I want you to talk about, you know, where you're coming from with that. I mean, you're obviously echoing, you know, Marinetti and people like that. But there's also this idea of, you know, this kind of poetry and this kind of fusion of the godlike, and
yeah.
You know, he becomes this modernist hero,
yeah.
But he's thinking of Hölderlin, you know, and
yeah.
I just want to know, you know, what you're trying to do there.
Well, the Hölderlin thing, I mean, it turns out that German World War One soldiers were actually handed out Hölderlin alongside
yeah.
their spam and whatever else,
right.
Whereas the English just got like A. Houseman or some crap, you know. So I mean, it was the better side to be on from the German point of view, definitely, or from the poetic literary point of view. But I mean, this idea, yeah, it is, those passages are heavily leaning on Marinetti, of course. But it's not just, you know, I mean, people associate Marinetti with just technology and maybe fascism, and but he's actually very interesting, you know. He kind of, for me, he kind of anticipates lots of writers like Alain Robbe Grier and thinkers like Lacan. It's all about geometry.
Mm.
So the reason he likes war is that space becomes geometry. It's about the trajectories of ordnance and the grids of maps.
And he's
and
happy
things.
That he sees things flatly. He's
oh,
happy.
Serge is very happy to see things flat. And so being amidst the I mean, Pynchon is in there a lot as well, right? The parabola of the bombs and stuff. I mean, but being among this kind of geometry, he almost feels that he's kind of becoming geometry, or that he's becoming some kind of inscription. I mean, that thing with Hölderlin, it's as close as you can get without actually quoting to a particular bit of Heidegger, which is it's from his essay What Are Poets
yeah.
For, and he takes those very lines,
the
Abgrund, he takes lines from that same poem, Patmos, and Hölderlin's idea that the poet goes into the abyss, which is actually a kind of almost like a palimpsest.
Yeah.
A pad which is full of tracks and traces, the marks of the vanished god, the kind of material inscriptions, the remainders, and the poet kind of reads them. And this is very much what Serge is doing. So the sky becomes a kind of archive, and it becomes this. Also, you know, he's facing backwards as well, which is like, that's Benjamin, like the angel of history, faces backwards. But it turns out the observer on planes actually did face backwards.
It's wonderful. He's there. He's in. You know. He's in this Abgrund. He's marking this kind of abyss.
Yeah.
And he's feeling the weight of gravity pulling him back down.
Yeah.
And, you know, most people associate gravity with death. And he's. You know. He is this godlike figure in the face of kind of death in the
yeah.
abyss. And Hölderlin talks about, you know, to paraphrase him, that, you know, it's when we're in this godless, the gods can't really do that much, but it's up to mortals to strike into the abyss to make that.
But Hölderlin has this is something that crazy German guy Kitzler is really good about writing about, that Hölderlin is ultimately a kind of, the whole thing for Hölderlin is acoustic. I mean, it kind of anticipates, well, I mean, so for Hölderlin, the reason that the poet needs to go into the Abgrund, the abyss, and read the traces is to make everything resound again and make Pan sing once more. And I love the idea that technology does this. This is, you know, kind of what a record needle is doing. I mean, it's an absolutely literal level. There have been marks laid down by someone else who's gone, and the needle is kind of reading it and making some kind of harmony or whatever, static. Harmony and static mixed together. And so I suppose, I mean, early in the book, Serge and his sister spend so long looking at needles and records, listening to dead German children called Rainer's voices. And so the war kind of becomes an expansion of that. The tracks of the battlefield are grooves. And
it seems to be this mapping and recording
And replaying. And
Which ties into your, this, you know, there's lots of people have had lots of fun, including yourself, with, you know, the letter C and everything associated with it, and also with technology and everything else, the poetry, which is in this book. But there's also I remember when we spoke and you said you were writing this, and I says, oh, what's C about, you know? And you says, oh, it's about mourning with a U, and, you know, and melancholia, and, you know, and I'd not read Freud for such a long time, and it is absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's just so spot on. And I want you to talk about how mourning and melancholia ties in with this, but also how, I mean, you've written extensively about this kind of projection of that voices from the dead via technological means and things like that. And I just want you to talk about this. There's also an image within the book of the lac beetle. And, you know, it secretes this...
Yeah, shellac. That's what records were made out of.
Which the records were made out of then.
Yeah.
But this also ties in with kind of Freud, you know, the black bile and things like this.
Serge mishears it as lack with a K.
Yeah, am I lacking? You know, but he
is the lack beetle.
Exactly, and you know, I want to know how that works with it, and I want to know, you know, he seems to have this steadfast refusal to mourn what Freud would call the lost object, which is his sister who sadly dies. I want to know how all that works.
Well, Freud makes this kind of this classical distinction between mourning on the one hand and melancholia on the other. So mourning is, you know, you lose someone and you mourn for a bit, you know, if it's a girlfriend, it's 2 months, if it's a family member, it's 2 years or what, you know, and then you replace the object and you move on. And with melancholia, this process the object never gets replaced. So it just, he uses all this really rich vocabulary, like it's like an open wound that suppurates and infects the whole system. And, so the lost one is kind of replaced, but by a void, by an internal kind of crypt. And later writers like Derrida kind of, Derrida calls it kind of internal vomiting, like this kind of ejection, but inside. And so I guess this is what Serge is doing. I mean, he refuses to mourn. I'm not interested in kind of sentimentalism at all, and I wanted really to reject that at every level. And because melancholia is a much more interesting kind of process. I mean, if you think of in literature, you know, Hamlet, Antigone, all these classic figures, they're all melancholics. It's a much kind of more productive and disruptive and also melancholia takes the form of a set of encryptions, right? The whole world becomes a site of mourning. So Serge can't mourn, but then the world becomes the screen in which this loss is mourned. So the war itself is a kind of melancholic kind of activity.
It's interesting that you say he refuses to be sentimental. I mean, this will tie into other things that I'm going to ask you about, you know, the humanist tradition and things like that. But, you know, he refuses to mourn. And you, structurally within this, you're kind of, you obsess about the brute materiality of things. You obsess about matter.
Yeah.
You know, so there's this minute detail of the lac beetle secreting it's, you know, this black substance, and throughout the novel there's the motif of this blackness, this inkiness, this sea of ink, and then towards the end, you know, there's this kind of image of Serge, who he He's sweating black, and it's mixed in with.
And he's got this Shakespeare sonnet in his head that just goes, that in black ink, my love may still shine bright. It's like a stuck needle as he kind of dies.
So
I told you the end, but.
But I can tell it's not that kind of book, is there? I don't think there's any spoilers, really.
No, but the material, I mean, Melancholia was originally conceived as a material. Melachole means black bile, and it was thought in the medieval, you know, in the Middle Ages, that melancholics had an excess of black bile in their stomach, and they needed to kind of...
People would take to the waters.
And try and wash it out and become wholesome and good again. So I guess I'm kind of... I mean, in Remainder too, there's an absolute kind of materialism to it, not in a kind of Marxist sense, but in a kind of, you know, sticky, messy excessiveness of matter. In a way, that's the real hero of the books. And I wanted to play out not just mourning, but all of the associated issues around like writing and you know, whatever, desire and everything, totally materially. I mean, there's the scene where he goes and debunks the spiritualist.
Yeah.
But even as he exposes him and the crowd kind of smash his magic table, this little, it looks like a drop of oil, and it's a little bug, that a little woodlouse or something that comes out. So there's this kind of, it's a kind of double play. I mean, there are remainders and revenants and returners from the dead, but they're material, always material.
Yeah, I think that's a theme that you hold within everything you do, basically this idea that everything returns, everything will. Within the book, there's the part where they're explaining the signals are bouncing in between the Earth's, you know, the atmosphere, and one day, you know, they're going to return, and we may be able to tune into things that have already happened. But
it's true. I mean, there are aliens listening to 1930 radio shows as we speak.
Marconi's SOS.
Exactly. Yeah. There were these amazing theories though in the kind of in the 20s about what are those bits of static? Is it just residues? Are we hearing the first three S's that went across the Atlantic?
You seem to want to kind of, you know, articulate that as well. But there's a book that you quote from in interviews, Aberrations of Mourning, Writing on German Crypts. And there's a quote from this: every point of contact between a body and its media extension marks the site of some secret burial.
Yeah.
Now, within C, there's all the kind of Marinetti things happening, and you've also said in INS manifestos and declarations that the future begins with a car crash. You know, the avant-garde has already been derailed. It's already failed in its kind of
inception.
So, you know, there's a very strategic moment in this. There's the car crash, and then we have this complete change where he's off to Egypt, and there's this almost kind of archaeology happening, but it's also very Freudian. It's also like he's kind of curing himself. There's lots of these labyrinthine kind of scenes where he's, you know, he's in the tombs and he's going down to different antechambers and different chambers, and it's almost like he's within himself trying to cure himself.
But he's
like
kind of
this.
Pulling, you know, what's that material called that they use for roads?
Bitumen.
Yeah. Like tarmac. It's full of bitumen and limbs and bones and just rubbish. And some of it's Lipton's tea from 2 years ago, and some of it is some Egyptian pharaohs.
And there's this kind of archaeology, not only of himself, kind of, but also of literature, and also of, you know, our kind of history and, you know, and the empire and things like this. And there's so much going on there. But there's also this kind of motif of the crypt, the burial, and also this idea that voices are kind of mediated there from beyond. This is the motif of the record, and I always think of HMV, his master's voice. It's a dog looking at a record player, listening to a voice. And I heard, or you may have told me, that it didn't used to be a record player. It was a coffin.
It was a coffin, yeah. The idea was that his master is dead, but the dog doesn't know it because...
Yeah, and with
the voice,
with also with telephone
so
boxes,
good.
Weren't they were.
Yeah, the guy that designed them also he designed the crypt, in fact, at that church just on Euston Road, and that's why they have that funny kind of thing at the top.
So throughout your work, there's this idea that, you know, voices are being recorded, and the dead is still with us, and in this book, Lawrence Rickles, he talks, you know, death shouldn't be called death, it should be this kind of...
I know he says mourning shouldn't be, the word mourning is no longer adequate, we should call it the audio and video broadcasts of improper burial. So mourning is, all media is mourning and all mourning is media, which is a very extreme, but I mean it's a brilliant book actually, it was quite a good kind of compass for me, that this aberrations of mourning.
Excellent. Well, there's this idea, you know, Serge refuses to mourn, and but I read it as, you know, he refuses to engage with a certain tradition of writing. You call it, you know, you don't want him to be sentimental.
Yeah.
Now, it's really weird. There's been lots of kind of reviews of your novel, and people have been calling it experimental or an anti-novel. I mean, if that's an anti-novel, I don't know what a novel is, because it's not an anti-novel. So I just want you to kind of talk about why people aren't really getting this kind of anti-humanist kind of manifesto that everything you have kind of produced is.
I don't know why. I mean, some do, some don't. I mean, I think there are kind of... I think this is becoming more and more clear to me. I mean, it seems to me that the two cultures that, you know, that term that C.P. Snow used to talk about art and science, I don't think it's art and science anymore after, like, Ballard or Gravity's Rainbow and stuff. I mean, it's not that they seem to be operating quite well together in many ways. I think it's the two cultures that are kind of more or less irreconcilable, a kind of humanism on the one hand, and on the other, whatever, tradition, discourse, practice, whatever you want to call it, that's kind of informed by modernism and by modernity and by psychoanalysis and philosophy and all the amazing stuff that's happened in the last 100 years, which has galvanized literature and given it so many potentials, but a road that it's closed is this kind of sentimental... I mean, I'm not talking about, you know, centuries of great secular humanism. I'm talking about a kind of regressive sentimentalism, which I unfortunately is kind of the dominant mode within the publishing industry. It's kind of what is expected of you if you're a writer trying to get your first novel published. That is what everyone wants. And I just don't see how the two kind of whatever camps seem to rest on such utterly, utterly different conceptions of everything, of what it is to write, what it is to represent, what a self is, what a subject is. I mean, I just can't see. I gave my mother this book by Claude Simon, who's brilliant. You know, he won the Nobel Prize. He's fantastic. And it was Triptych, I think. Yeah, it was Triptych. And I mean, you know, she's an academic and she read it and liked it very much. But she said, if this is literature, and it is, but if this is literature, then what mainstream British fiction is doing isn't, and vice versa. They're just not, they shouldn't be allowed to be called the same thing, you know, because it's just diverged so much. And that's the way it seems to me. I mean, I could be wrong. There could be, maybe there are points where they kind of meet in the middle, but I can't really think of any.
It's funny. Some people just don't know where to kind of categorise it. I mean, you've been called the kind of, you know, as I said just then, this anti-novelist, which you're not, and this experimental writer, which you're not really. And then
Burroughs is experimental. I mean, this has a quite conventional 19th century kind
but
mainframe.
But then people think, oh, it's a historical novel. But I would, it's not a historical novel.
That's a bit of a red, yeah.
I see it. He's thrust into existence, Serge. He moves forward, but there's also this movement back as well, where you're kind of excavating, you know, there's this archaeology happening as well. But there's also a loop, and it kind of made me think of Beckett's Crap's Last Tape. You know, this technology doesn't take you forward.
It's about an embedding. It's about a kind of everything becoming richer. I mean, Beckett's, you know, I mean, he's a hero of mine, and especially in Remainder, the kind of all the logic behind the repetitions.
Yeah.
That if you repeat the same thing again and again and again, it's not boring. It's actually really, it's why kids redo Zidane's goal in the playground the next day 100 times, because it becomes richer and richer and more intimacy with kind of details and mnemonic little ciphers and so on. And so that's very much, I think, the way that you know, that angel of history thing. I mean, if the angel of history faces backwards, definitely the angel of literature does. And the most radical and you know, new writers like Joyce, you know, I mean, the reason Finnegan's Wake is so new is because it's so regressive in a way. Mm. He's looking back to the origins of literature and just kind of embedding everything in it. I mean, and in a way, actually, even Finnegan's Wake is very traditional. It's got the main drivers of, you know, it's got the family and economics and kind of like Balzac or something,
yeah.
Or Dickens, you know. So anyhow, yes, to the loop and everything. Agree, yes. But also, sorry, just talking Finnegan's Wake, I mean, I think after Joyce, you kind of just realise everything is code. Or after Rob Grier, there's nothing more authentic about realism than about anything else. I mean, realism is a literary convention. It's
yeah.
as laden with artifice as anything else. There's nothing more actually. Burroughs used to say, you know, my cut-ups are a more realistic depiction of what mental activity is like and what experience is like than a kind of novel that begins on the 12th of December, comma. Mm. You know, I got out of bed, comma, and thinking of this, walked down the street. I mean, it's not how you live.
No,
the cut-up is out. So anyhow, everything is a convention. And once you realise this, that there's, you know, I didn't have any anxiety I didn't have any anxiety about using a particular type of code as the mainframe, you know, that there's this kind of realist code, because it's just another code. And also it's a kind of Trojan horse. I mean, it's the one that allows you to do in this climate what you want to do most effectively, rather than Xeroxing cut-ups in editions of 50.
I think,
and handing
yeah.
them out in pubs.
I think, well, it all ties in. I mean, everything you, from your conceptual kind of art background to your manifestos with the INS, and all your novels, even your book on Tintin should be read with this, because it's, you know, that everything is an explanation, and also this kind of anti-humanist kind of stance you take. But the quote that I want to leave it on that I really love was from your review of Jean-Philippe Toussaint's work, and in it you say, we don't want plot, depth or content, we want angles, arcs and intervals, we want pattern. Structure is content and geometry is everything. And I think if any kind of book epitomises that, I think you've achieved it with C. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Great.
So I suppose I'd better open it up to everyone here, if anyone would like to ask Tom a question.
Is it on? Yes.
Hello. I read C, and then I wanted to just stay in the subject matter, and then I revisited Finnegan's Wake, and then I stopped doing that. And then I read, and then I'm reading Solaris at the moment, and I think there's something about, I haven't really formalised this yet, but there's something about the relationship of the woman or the dead woman and how she sits in between the transmission and the reception,
yeah.
And you know, in Solaris the message is just pure information, she's the dead wife, but there's
yeah.
no message really,
yeah,
and
she's just reconstituted
yeah.
and unconstituted
and
materially, she kind of melts
exactly
and yeah.
Serge's these kind of repetitive encounters
yeah.
he has with women, they're sort of noise in between
yeah.
his. And I don't really know what that is, but it kind of is interesting to me. I don't know if you, and the dead sister and how she's kind of constantly interfering with his,
yeah.
I don't know, his narrative.
Well, no, totally. I mean, she becomes the kind of, Finnegan's Wake was a real, whatever, template or beacon for this book, because of this relationship between the family and technology and incest and insects, you know, which is a kind of switcheroo he keeps doing, and insectuousness and, you know, all the mutations he takes all those things through, and archaeology. I mean, yeah, I wasn't directly thinking of Solaris. I mean, I love that film, and I've seen it like about five times, and it's brilliant. And And it is kind of, yeah, Orpheus and Eurydice and all that. And, but I was thinking quite a lot. I mean, in fact, often when I write, I think about Tarkovsky because his, with when it's descriptive passages, because he's so descriptive and so material as well. I mean, people that kind of say he's a Christian, I think, are just utterly missing the point. I think it's all about, like that bit in Stalker where he's just lying, there's a kind of 7-minute shot and he's lying by the river and it's dirty and there's oil in it and there's broken icons and guns and kind of bleeding cartridges of broken guns, and it's all just mishmashed together, this huge kind of material archive. It's all about a kind of materiality of surface and of psychic life in Tarkovsky and in Joyce. Joyce is a total materialist, this obsession with shit, you know, in his life and his work. And so yeah, no, all these things are, yeah, sure, absolutely.
You were talking on the one hand about literature, sentimental literature, and on the other hand you were talking about modernism and anti-humanism, and in a way the ideas you were putting forth about melancholia, I mean, melancholia is suffused with feeling, by now the relationship between technology and melancholia and the background that we have by now, it is, I wouldn't say sentimental, but it's certainly suffused with feelings of nostalgia and for what it is, what could have been, and also the sheer excitement of technology is also very much suffused with feeling, with something that is like, I wouldn't say sentimental, but it's certainly there's an excitement there.
Oh yeah.
That is very much related to feeling. So how do you separate what is actually this kind of feeling and this kind of suffusion from sentimentality?
Well, this kind of what I was saying right at the beginning, maybe when you asked your first question, I mean, about desire. I mean, this novel is it's about love. It's a love novel. It's about desire. It's about an intensity of, I mean, a surge, right? A surge that's so strong it blows the whole circuitry. But I'm just not interested in kind of redacting that or letting it play out in a sentimental way, in a way that Serge is at his sister's funeral going, damn, I feel really sad, this is awful, and, you know, it's so much more... Okay, here's another two traditions thing. Psychology versus psychoanalysis, right? Psychology is a very, ultimately, a kind of humanist discourse. It's about how we feel and how we understand that, and the kind of psychoanalysis is totally different. It's about kind of structures and codes and but it's absolutely about, you know, excitement and about desire and drives, but for the psychoanalyst, you know, you don't listen to what someone says, you listen to what they're not saying, you listen to the rhythms, you look at their, you know, the way that words and images and memories have got meshed and translated and transformed and play out over time, and this is something that plays out at a level much bigger than the individual, and it's just so much more dynamic. You know, for a psychologist, if you want to understand mental life, you take a biopsy of a murderer's brain, whereas for Freud, you read Antigone. I mean, I know what I'd rather be doing, you know, then you read Hamlet, then you go and look at David Lynch's films, and so on and so on. I mean, so does that yeah, different ways of construing and thinking about desire, I'd say, yeah.
Hi. This might be quite a bland question, but I actually really want to know the answer, so I'm going to ask it anyway. You talked about looking at different angles and patterns in literature, and I thought that was really interesting. And I haven't read Sea yet, but that definitely was the case in Remainder. And I was wondering, do you enjoy looking and creating patterns and angles more with the plot and with the story, or with the language and with the way you execute it?
Well, kind of both, really. I mean, it's quite hard to kind of separate them out. I mean, when I had the idea for C, I was I kind of knew what was going to happen in terms of the plot, that it was going to start in this kind of Arcadian family estate and end in Egypt and go through the war, and it would all revolve around the dead sister and so on and so on. And but what I realised straight away as well, I was reading, I was reading not Freud, but the Wolfman's own account of his life, which is really interesting. It's like really good fiction. Well, I mean, it is. Yeah. but what's important in his mental life is, and it's very Finnegan's Wake-ish. I mean, the way that kind of monads of clusters of kind of associations kind of grow, and almost like some kind of cancer or something, and they link to other ones that are continually kind of feeding each other. And this is a very linguistic thing. So his actions often play out. Also, he's Russian and English and French, and he speaks all these languages which are all meshing together, like in Joyce. And so what I'm trying to say is, even events that in the plot of his life are actually just playing out linguistic kind of tropes and tendencies, and I wanted this book to be like that as well, and revolve around certain terms like insects and incest, and you know, there's lots of missed hearings, and Sistine becomes sister in Sistine chapels, and cysts, and you know, there's a whole bunch of kind of metonyms, if you like, that go through the book, and in a way that's the plot as much as the plot.
I think what's interesting about that, there's all that going on, but still Serge has this steadfast refusal. There's a bit in the book where he's with his fellow pilots, and there's been a series of accidents, and someone's crash died.
Oh, yeah, with the arms out.
And their body has putrefied into kind of acid, and it's scarred the grass. And one of his kind of fellow pilots goes, oh, you know, all those memories, all that desire, all that life there in the grass, and you go, turn to battery acid. And Serge goes, well, yeah, that's what we are. So there's all that going on in it, you know, all this. But yeah. He still steadfastly refuses to kind of, you know, acknowledge this kind of psychology.
No, but in a way that is his acknowledgement. I mean, he is the ultimate, I mean, like the guy in Remainder as well, he's the ultimate votive mourner, but he's so the guy in Remainder, when the drug dealer has been shot and the police have just taken the photos, cleared the street, you know, opened it up to traffic, the guy in Remainder goes back and back and back to that spot and reenacts 100 times the moment of his death through all the material traces, the cigarette butt half smoked, you know, the angle of the bit of the puddle, the angle of the bollard that looks like a column of a necropolis or something. And it's the same with Serge there. He's not dismissing this guy's life. He's saying the battery acid, that is the kind of,
it's like
Remainder. You know, there's a bit in Pound, you know, when he's totally going mad and he describes his brain as being like a leaky battery. Everything is just firing off. He says, I could not make it all cohere, radio metaphor. And so this moment of his kind of schizophrenia is experienced as a totally kind of material technological thing. I mean, that's not lesser. I think it's more. It's more.
Well, this kind of almost like the poetry of Francis Punge, where
absolutely.
You know, where the materiality of things are laid out bare and it's dissected, and you look at it for what it is, to see what it is.
But language kind of comes to grief within that dissection, and as things become sacred, and yeah.
We've all been very serious tonight talking about Heidegger and mourning and melancholia, but it occurred to me that in Lackbeetle is Lachen, and I wondered if the playfulness of the 20s, like the mashups, were supposed to be part of it as well.
Yeah, totally. I mean, he hangs out with all these kind of chorus girls who sing, you know, chorus reviews about Amazonians and how you have to keep abreast of everything, you know, if you're an Amazonian, and it's kind of, I guess that's a joke kind of thing. I was smiling a lot while I wrote it. Yeah. No, it's true, but that's, you're absolutely right. And what people, like even people like Adorno, when they write about Beckett, they just miss how funny it is. Or writing about Kafka, you know. I mean, it's kind of funny that someone wakes up as a beetle. It's kind of ridiculous, and that he can't even flip himself over.
But
you know,
Beckett said there's nothing funnier than unhappiness.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, yeah. No, this is something that in one of sorry, it's getting all serious again, but in one of INS declarations with that I wrote with Simon Critchley, we kind of go on a bit about how about comedy is actually much worse than tragedy. I mean, in tragedy you throw yourself into death in order to authentically kind of experience that moment transcendently and become heroic. And in comedy, that option's removed because you can't die properly. You know, Wile E. Coyote just gets shot and blown up again and again. And this is what you get in Beckett as well. Vladimir and Estragon just can't fucking die, you know. And it's just dreadful. And but it's funny as well.
The unspoken seriousness of that.
Yeah, but also, yeah, the flip side is the unspoken fun, or the hopefully spoken funniness of, I mean, Wile E. Coyote is kind of funny. this inability to die, yeah.
I kind of come from a non-literary background. I didn't really know your previous books. I didn't know if this was like first book or whatever. I only found out about it through a preview in a newspaper that kind of mentioned the key points of radio experimentalism, sort of turn of the century, Marconi, First World War, Egypt, all the girls and everything. And when I read it, I kind of have an amateur interest in sort of radio pioneers. And I kind of, not knowing that you do previous original works, I was thinking if you had maybe done a bit of a copy and paste life story of there's a guy called Peter Exley that I was sort of reading about, and I was thinking, all these key points, it kind of, I'm a bit concerned about this if it's just a copy and paste. And then when I read it, thankfully it wasn't.
That's good.
So I should make that very, very clear. He's an English guy, and his written notes are very English. And then when I was reading C...
Well, is he a historical figure? Is he from the early 20th
century? Yeah, early 20th century, sort of 22 onwards.
Was he the guy doing, like, ray guns and they were trying to do...
No. BBC, early radio engineer, kind of with that thing. And, yes, when I was reading C, the whole flow of the story compared to his life story, because I had that in mind or whatever, I was thinking, are you taking those bits, you know, which you hadn't. And I was thinking, why was it different? You know, why kind of did it feel different? And you kind of nailed it on the head the moment you said Germanic there, with it, with Heidegger and everything like that. And I just want to say, well done for making it very original.
Thanks for not copying this guy.
That is really interesting for it to be mentioned, the Germanic bent rather than the English bent of him traditionally being, say, English or whatever.
Right. Oh, thanks a lot. But there is a lot of copying and pasting, actually. I mean, like, there's Bell is in there a lot, and Marconi, whose parents met on a silk farm. And I mean, there was a lot of... And Bell's father ran a school for the deaf and would get the kids to recite poetry. And I mean, there is a lot of things that are taken and...
Should I go over here?
There's this gentleman in the grey shirt.
Cheers. There's always a real temptation with an author just to check you're getting your references right and that I'm spotting things that you're deliberately doing. So I'm kind of tempted to ask about Kafka and ghosts in the post and the ghosts that feed off transmission. And I'm kind of tempted to ask about Michael Serres and transmission and feedback. I think I am actually going to ask about Michael Serres' friend Hergé and just ask you if you've managed to kind of work out the neurosis of finding Jolyon Wag on the radio or Mr. Katz the butcher on the other end of the phone.
Yeah.
And really about the anxiety, you know, what are you doing with those inferences? I really want you to reassure me. I'm reading into your books in a successful and worthwhile way, and I really think I probably am.
Yeah, no, Tintin is, I mean, Hergé is, he's fantastic. I think he's as big an influence for me as Conrad or Shakespeare or something. I mean, I think he's a complete genius, and there's a richness and complexity to his work. And you know, not for nothing does, I mean, all the Egyptian stuff, I mean, straight Tintin, right? And in Tintin, you've got the family crypt at Marlinspike. I mean, Tintin enters it through the crypt, and then you're on the other side of the world, you've got these burial chambers that he always kind of penetrates somehow or other, and they're kind of the same space. And then there's an interesting family history with Hergé, which involves secret affiliation, and it's kind of too long to go into right now. And there's all this obsession with transmissions as well. I mean, Tintin, he's meant to be a journalist, but he only ever once actually files a story. What he actually does in the books is tune in again and again and again. He's a radio operator, tracking down signals and talking of Michel Serre. I mean, you know the essay he wrote, right, about the Castafiore Emerald. I mean, it's brilliant. And for him, that whole book is basically a kind of essay on... It's a treatise on communication, and all the media and the TV is there, and the message gets lost, and it's all about transmission breakdown. And so, yeah, no, Hergé and Serre, you know, but Hergé more is a huge influence, and you're not wrong at all to read it in there.
I know you said technology wasn't really the hero of the book, but to some extent, do you feel like you're kind of picking up where the future is left off, in that, you know, kind of man as becoming one with machine and kind of pushing you into the future?
I mean, there's definitely that moment in it. I mean, Marinetti is there, you know, and in the war bit, there are whole phrases that are lifted from spattering, you know, spatterings of half sentences in my book that I've taken straight from Marinetti as a kind of, you know, blatant, you know, citation or whatever, if you know the source. But I mean, there is a difference, you know. For Marinetti, it's year zero, it's everything, the past, just burn it, forget it. And I'm much more in, you know, this is the past is very, I'm more down with Faulkner on that. He says the past isn't dead, it's not even past, you know. And so Marinetti would have, I don't think he'd have been interested in that at all. But it's definitely, I mean, yeah, that's embedded in there. But I don't really see myself as taking it further. I don't see myself as taking anything further. I mean, it's not about going further. I mean, this is the question. This is the big question that the avant-garde in particular kind of poses. Like, what do you do after 4.5 minutes of silence, 4:33 by Cage? I mean, the challenge is not to do 5.5 minutes or 6.5. It's not. That's not what's interesting. Is it has to be navigated kind of differently, perhaps, and you know, Joyce understood everything as the loop, didn't he? I mean, it, literature doesn't progress. That was the commodious vicus of recirculation. It's all about going back into the rubbish tip, which is what literally happens at the beginning of Finnegan's Wake. There are letters, he calls it literature, you know, and then you go into the rubbish tip and bring out bits and recombine them and produce new stuff. It's not about going forwards, it's about going round.
You say in your INS...
which isn't the same as just straight-up repetition of the same. Sorry.
Yeah. You say in your INS declaration on the future, the point is that, historically speaking, we'd advance not into new ground, but over old ground in new ways. More consciously, with deeper and more nuanced understanding.
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of what
Joyce
did.
Yeah, totally. For Vico, the Joyce gets his idea of the loop from Vico, and the Italian word is ricorso, which is untranslatable because it has the sense of kind of a repetition, but also a legal sense of a retrial or an appeal. So there's a kind of historical, you know, which is, it's the type of thing like in Beckett's Happy Days, when Winnie, she does the same actions every single day, but she's aware of it. So she's going, you know, yesterday I came here and I took out this mirror and I took out this gun, and I'll do the same tomorrow, which means it's not the same because now we're not aware of having been here before. And if we come back tomorrow and reenact this,
so I can,
you know, there's and so on ad infinitum. It's like what Deleuze says, the only thing you can actually repeat is the difference. So yeah.
Thank you for joining us for this London Review Bookshop event. For more, visit our website at www.londonreviewbookshop.co.uk or search for the London Review Bookshop on iTunes.